as well as SoundCloud, on your station for jazz and justice, WPFW, Washington.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Fahima Sek, and the show is What's at Stake. We spend the hour with Dr. Ann Lundy, musical director of Community Music Center of Houston, where we will unpack her sojourn on to Black excellence, becoming one of the first African-American women to conduct a symphony orchestra. All that and a whole lot more. Good morning and welcome. I'm Fahima Sek, and the show is What's at Stake. And I want to thank you, Dr. Lundy, for agreeing to join us here on WPFW to go through an exploration of your sojourn. I know you're on the heels of a phenomenal concert that took place at the Miller Theater, and you have a great deal of accomplishments and have done some really significant things. But we want to start out to see how you started out. I know you started with an interest in music and you were educated in the state of Texas, but how did you get introduced to music and then classical music?
Well, I did grow up in Houston, and I have an older sister. She's 6 years older than me, Jessica, and she was doing music. She was playing the flute. Anything my older sister was doing, I wanted to do. So I was just a little, you know, little sister that just ran behind her big sisters or whatever she was doing. I didn't wind up with the flute. I wound up, in my case, with the violin. She was taking piano lessons. So I started taking piano lessons, too. So it was very much a family thing. Of course, I had supportive parents. Mom and Dad were always taking me to music lessons, music rehearsals, music contests, music. Oh, you name it. We spent our lives in the car going to whatever. Kind of like you hear the stories about soccer moms or basketball parents. So spend all your time taking the kids somewhere. That was my story of just one where I was kind of just following my big sister. I just fell in love with the world of orchestra.
I understand you started out playing the violin.
Yes, I did. I just liked the sound. And part of it also was that I liked that the sound when I played with other kids, because I was going through kids school orchestras and then youth orchestras. I really liked the combination of sounds. To me, it was just a really lovely floral almost sound to my ears. It just, you know, felt the way you might if you're looking at beautiful flowers. That's kind of the way I felt about listening to the beautiful music, even if it was a kids group and they didn't sound all that great. To me, the sound was terrific. So I just loved that sound, and it just kind of set my imagination free, and I just kind of imagined different visual things along with this. It's so funny because I've got a friend who's a visual artist. Pardon me. And it was always that what things that she would kind of see and I would kind of hear and she would hear and I would see, you know, it's just kind of this combination of the arts, how they kind of were partners almost.
So when did you decide you wanted to go to school to study music? I know you said you started out playing the violin at a very young age. Your sister was playing the flute. But, you know, young people do have various interests over time. But what is it that made you say, I want to go to school and study music? Because, again, you did your undergrad, your graduate, master's degree, and eventually a doctoral degree in music education. When is it and how is it that you made the determination that I'm going to major in music? Because, I mean, some people, you know, they play sports, they have interests, they have hobbies. But what is it that made you decide, I want to major in music in college?
This does take me way back. I was a little girl, maybe just a little bitty thing, 4 or 5 years old, at a school. And they let me get up and wave my hands around in front of another school kids group they were playing. And I got to be the leader. And from the very beginning, I loved it. I just loved it. I was waving my hands around and all those kids were playing music. And it was just, for me, it was magic almost. I love the way I would wave my hands and they would make music. They would play sounds, even if it may have been twinkle, twinkle. I mean, I don't know what it was about, but just the fact that they were looking at me and
you were conducting that orchestra.
I was conducting that orchestra. And you know, it's kind of funny because being that it happened so early, I think I was too young to know that, I'm going to show my age, that I was a little black girl that didn't go into orchestra conducting. I was so young that I fell in love with it. It was just a bug that bit me so hard. From then on, all I would do with my life is see as many different opportunities as I could to conduct anybody anywhere. I didn't care who they were, what they were doing. Do you want to conduct? Yes. You don't want to conduct this? Yes. Do you want to conduct this? Yes. I was just anytime, anywhere. It didn't make any difference to me. I would try to conduct because I just loved it. Still do.
And so you made the decision to major in music. How did you make the decision to, I think you went to University of Texas in Austin, is that correct?
That's right, UT Austin. That was my undergrad. Yeah, so
let's unpack. How did you end up there? What made the decision? We want to walk through your footprints and see how you came of age. We've got that you were introduced to music because your sister was playing the flute and you decided to play the violin and you had the opportunity to conduct at a very young age when you didn't even understand it was conducting. So how did you end up at University of Texas at Austin? How did that happen? What was the defining moment?
Some of it is that I'm one of those people that believes in blessings. I was finishing up my high school degree and we were just kind of looking around at where were there decent orchestras. Because I knew at an early age I was going to be a musician. As we looked around, I was in Houston, but I wanted to go a little bit away from home. I wasn't ready at that point to go to New York or Los Angeles or whatever, but I definitely wanted to get out of Houston, be a young lady on her own. And Austin was a really good choice for me. UT Austin had a terrific orchestra. And it gave me a time to grow musically. My undergrad at that point was in music ed, violin. I was really blessed that my violin teacher, Stephen Clapp, he passed away a few years ago. He was just a great, great instructor. Though I was not his best player, he just really inspired me and I think everybody else to just really do our best and continue growing musically. While I was there, I would talk to other classmates. Most of the time, through my existence, I was the one black kid in the orchestra, and that just kind of became a fact of life. So after a while, you just kind of accept it, like, okay, I'm the one black person in the orchestra. Okay, I guess I better work on that Beethoven piece or that Mozart's kind of that tricky section or whatever. On one hand, I just concentrated on the music and tried not to get too caught up in racial issues at that time. But I'm old enough to say that's 1972, and this was very much at a time when this was just a few years after the King assassination, the unrest, the Vietnam War, the protest, and the civil rights protest was really going full steam. So at Austin, I really got a chance to meet some other black kids, some other black, you know, undergrads and grad students, and kind of get a better understanding as to what it meant to be a black person, love classical music, and yet loved other kind of music, because I was a kid that grew up loving Motown and the Philadelphia sound and Atlantic Records, you know, with Aretha. And I grew up loving the pop music of that age. So I guess I was just kind of mixture of different kinds of things, becoming a young woman at UT Austin.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio, and the show is What's at Stake. My guest today is Dr. Ann Lundy, Executive Director of the Music Center of Houston, and we're unpacking her sojourn. She's on the heels of the program you did at the Miller Theater was the Philly Sound 5 with a tribute to Frankie Beverly and Maze, and we're going to get into that in terms of how you bridged classical music with contemporary music. But we're still unpacking your sojourn in terms of how you came to where you currently are. So you mentioned that this was during the period of unrest in the 60s. We had the assassination of MLK, and this was a very interesting time in the country. So you can continue with what's next.
Well, at that point, I was continuing to play, you know, mainstream classical music, but I just started wondering, have Black composers written any classical music? And initially, I did not know, couldn't say yes or no. I didn't know nothing about it. I remember this is one of my classes I got into it with one of my professors, and he was saying something about this white composer that had used some degree of jazz, Stravinsky's use of jazz, and I raised my hand like I knew something, you know, when you're an undergrad. Well, having Black composers use jazz in their setting? He said, you know, I don't know. Why don't you go look that up and get back to us, bring a report back to us? And at that moment, I was thinking, you just put more work on your plate. But it turned out to be a blessing because it made me start acting on my curiosity. So I started reading books, reading journals. There's a lot of scholarship out there. It's just not in mainstream classical education. I have 3 degrees in music, and in the university setting, I learned nothing about Black composers and their many contributions. But if you just spend a little bit of time, and I know this is before all the things online, and so it was like you had to actually go to a library and pick up a book, read the book. So I was reading some of the books and some of the journals. Dr. Eileen Southern, who taught at Harvard for a number of years, and she'd written a number of books about the Black perspective in music, and she had a scholarly journal. And there were all kinds of scholars over the years, ranging from some of it during the time of enslavement on up to that time, that were keeping track of the Black contribution to the world of classical music, like Marian Anderson or Roland Hayes. Those were some of the great singers of even the time before and during that time. I was instrumentalist as a violin and violist. I wanted to see what had been happening in the world of orchestra. What were violin pieces by Black composers, violin concerto, violin solos, written for viola, written for cello, those kinds of things. And again, it was just old-fashioned reading books, reading journals. And I started going to conferences too. There are a number of conferences, Chicago, New York, and things like that, where again, scholars, a lot of them through connected with universities, would have a 3-day conference or a week conference on music of Black composers. And I started going to some of those. And again, I just learning so much. One of the great things about going to conference is you meet so many great people. You meet scholars, you meet other people. Some of them at that time, I was still a very young woman who were just getting started, along with established scholars who had written the books, who had written about these symphonies and the operas and the ballets and those kinds of things by Black composers. And I would just be sitting there learning and listening to the music and asking questions and found out that there is so much that we just don't know.
And now I understand that the Scott Joplin Orchestra, he's from Texas. Yeah, could you talk a little bit about him? We're going to get into your doctoral thesis, and I suspect it may have had something to do with Black composers, but we're going to make that a cliffhanger. Talk a little bit about Scott Joplin, if you will.
Well, he was born up in Texarkana, which is right at that Texas-Arkansas border. He didn't receive much formal music training. He was a very skilled musician, and he listened and listened and listened to music, and he would just imitate the sounds and so forth. And he was fascinating. And then he started finding his own voice in terms of what we would soon call ragtime. And at that point, ragtime was still a new form. You might think of early hip hop or something like that, just at the very beginning of this music. Some people thought that the music, it wasn't very good. It wasn't very polished, like some people might have said about early rap. But it would grow and mature to the point where it would take on this moniker of ragtime, which to me is really jazz. This is early jazz. And the way Scott Joplin would write these wonderful songs and Maple Leaf Rag or The Entertainer or Soliloquy, he wrote lots and lots of beautiful rags. But he was also interested in other kinds of music. That's another reason why we named ourselves after him. That's why we called the Scott Joplin Chamber Orchestra, because he just represents so much about, to me, of what Black folk, even if you haven't had the most perfect situation. And like I said, he received almost no formal music education, but he listened, He just worked really hard and just really desired to be good at this.
So Scott Joplin had no formal training, so he would be known as one who learned to play by ear.
Sort of, yes. But he would learn also how to write music. I'm saying that he received very little formal training, but then he would just go and just hang out. He did have some formal training, but it was, relatively speaking, kind of limited. But he was one of those persons that loved music, and he loved writing music and coming up with different songs. That's what we named Isaiah after him, because he's the epitome of somebody who has not had the great advantages, didn't have the money, didn't the kinds of things that we associate with classical music for the rich people, you know, those kinds of things. He didn't have any of that. But he loved music, and he loved studying music as best he could, and he still managed to write beautiful music in spite of his limitations.
So in your research, you learned about Scott Joplin and you founded the Scott Joplin Chamber Orchestra. And I see also at the Music Center, you founded the William Still String Quartet. Tell me, how were you introduced to William Grant Still?
Well, again, it was just reading books in the library. When I started finding about William Grant Still and his many accomplishments, and it's so funny because lately I've been reading more about some of the enslavement and one of the abolitionists, William Still, or something like that. I'm sorry, the names are very similar, but I believe William Grant Still, they made it a point so that he would know that he was not the abolitionist, but he was a trained musician. But William Grant Still was the first Black composer to have a symphony performed by a professional orchestra. I believe that's 1930, the Rochester Philharmonic, if I remember correctly. And then he was also the first Black composer to have a full opera performed by a professional opera company. And he wrote lots of different kinds of music. William Grant Still was a prolific composer. He wrote lots and lots of music. He worked with a blues musician. He worked with W.C. Handy, father of the blues. So if you ever, you know, those great blues songs, W.C. Handy, William Grant Still was working with him and writing some of the music down. He did receive the formal training, William Grant Still did. And he also relocated eventually out in California, and he would write for some smaller films. He wrote for television. And so if you're ever looking at some of those old TV shows, maybe staying up late at night, he wrote music for some of the music for Gunsmoke and for the old and for the old Perry Mason show.
Yeah, I remember the theme for the Perry Mason show coming up as a kid.
Yes, though, so he was a prolific composer. He wrote, quote, classical music in terms of his many symphonies. But he also, you know, like I said, he was working with blues music, and he was also working with TV music. And he wrote lots of music. I'm sure there's more music that I don't know. He was somebody that I emulated, someone I admired, somebody said, oh, please. So that's when actually the quartet precedes the orchestra. I formed the William Grant Still String Quartet. I'm not sure I'd have that name at first, but the William Grant Still String Quartet, I believe, in 1978, while I was working on my master's at University of Houston. That was one of those times when I approached the music department. Couldn't they do a concert on music of Black composers? They hadn't done that before. And they were like, well, yeah, if you want to organize it. That's what my
answer was. Well, there you go again, raising questions that ended up resulting in you having to embark on a project.
That's my entire life. And saying, let's do this. And they're like, well, okay, you do it. And we'll look at it when you're through with it. That's been my entire life. But I've enjoyed it because I've got a chance to learn so much and meet fascinating people. Well, because sometimes you just don't know if somebody might be interested in something unless you ask them.
Now, you make mention of working on your master's and then suggesting that they do in graduate school a concert on Black composers. Okay, so folks, they do a degree in music and they may decide to become a music teacher. What is it that compelled you to say, well, I'm going to go and get my master's in music? How did that happen? What was the impetus and the motivation for that?
Well, my undergrad was in music education, all levels. And both of my parents were educators. My dad was a coach. My mom was a reading teacher. So in their mind, education, you finish your college degree, you got a job teaching school. That was it. You know, you
right.
can do it.
That would be the natural path.
That would be the natural path. So, of course, he insisted that I do that. I was like, okay, you know, sure, whatever. But my master's degree is in orchestra conducting. And that was the first time I really got a chance to follow what I truly love, conducting orchestra. That's where I was at University of Houston, working in the graduate program in the music department. That's when I asked about the Music of Black Composers concert. I formed my first Black string quartet. It was kind of a mixed string quartet at that point. As I started talking to more and more people, I started learning again that there are Black folk that play the violin, that play the cello. It's not like something that comes up in a conversation like, hi, how you doing? Do you play the violin? But you'd be surprised if you talk to somebody, statistically, somebody in that experience will have said, well, yes, I used to play the violin when I was in elementary school, or I remember I played the oboe in concert band, or it's the kind of thing where we just don't, it's not typical that we think of it. As I started talking to people and learning about people, I just found that more and more Black folk were involved in this. So from there, like I said, in graduate school, I formed the string quartet named the William Grant Still String Quartet. I got some wonderful help from his daughter, Judith Still, and I started collecting music. And that was the other thing that I've spent my life doing, is collecting music by Black composers as much as I can, as soon as I can, just buying it up, because got to get your hands on the music, because that's the other thing that we do in Houston with my Scott Joplin Chamber Orchestra. We have Black players performing music by Black composers, and that is unique.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio. I'm Fahima Sack, and the show is What's at Stake. Today, my guest is Dr. Ann Lunday, who is one of the first African-American women to conduct the Houston Symphony Orchestra. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back on the other side of this.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of April 28, 2025. Beginning on Thursday, May 1st, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Dr. Nubia Kai will launch her new book, A River of Prophecy, Constructing a Sacred History of African Americans at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. On Friday, May the 2nd, from 6 to 9 p.m., the Foster and Adoptive Parent Advocacy Center is hosting their third annual gala for foster care at the MLK Library on the rooftop terrace, fifth floor of 901 G Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, please visit eventbrite.com. Also on Friday, May 2nd, from 3 to 5 p.m., the Young and Gifted Carter Bonus will speak at his panel, Swinging the Spectrum, How Autism Became My Superpower on and off the golf course at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. To hear more about his journey, attend this event, and for more info, visit sankofa.com. On Saturday, May 3rd, from 2 to 8 p.m., D.C. Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression presents the Butler Family Cookout at 2639 Burney Place, Southeast Washington, D.C. To contact for questions or more info, reach out to dcaarpr@gmail.com. On Sunday, May 4th, from 7 to 9 p.m., there is a Sudan on Our Mind, Stories from Sudan panel discussion being hosted at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, go to sankofa.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Thank you.
we're back.
We just heard the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Symphony No. 1, Afro-American, composed by the Dean of African-American Composers, William Grant Still.
I'm Fahima Sek, and the show is What's at Stake. My guest today is Dan Lundy, the musical director of the Community Music Center of Houston. She founded the Scott Joplin
Chamber Orchestra
and the William Grant Still String Quartet. Dr. Lundy, I too, in junior high school, was one who played the violin. You mentioned prior to the break, you'd be surprised of the Black people who played the violin, and I still have one, and I play it as a form of therapy. I'm not very good, but I do play it therapeutically too. Just to relax.
Keep it up. You don't have to be a professional musician to enjoy participating in music. And I still love listening to music. I do. I get in the car and I turn up my favorite sounds too. But I'm saying when you participate in the music, when you get home, you play Twinkle Twinkle, you play Mary Had a Little Lamb, it doesn't matter. You play a church song, it doesn't matter what you play. Just as long as you are actively participating in music. Because I believe that music has healing powers. I truly believe that.
Indeed. You did your undergraduate degree, then you did your master's in conducting. And what prompted you to go and receive your doctoral degree in music education, if I'm not mistaken? And what was your thesis on?
So I did go right from undergraduate to graduate school and then finish that. What happened in the meantime is that's when I approached the Houston Symphony about us doing a joint venture, because this is, you know, a few years after finishing my master's. The Houston Symphony had no Black players, and that was the reality in most symphony orchestras at that time, and there's still a very paltry number of Black players that are in, especially professional orchestras. Houston Symphony has one Black member now, Judy Dines, great lady. To me, I just feel like I'm a life battle of trying to get the professional orchestras to really, truly be inclusive. I approached them, that would have been in 1989, about doing a joint orchestra concert between my orchestra, the Black player, Scott Joplin Chamber Orchestra, and the Houston Symphony. And what I said was 1989 was the 90th anniversary of the birth of William Dawson. He had written this wonderful piece called Negro Folk Symphony. And that was the year he was still alive. And that was the year of his 90th celebration. A few other orchestras, Houston Symphony wasn't doing anything. And so we approached them, could we do this together? And our players and your players performed together. And as I said, they had no Black players in 1989. And they said yes. After a while, it took a little convincing, but after a while, they finally came around to the idea of us doing this together and me conducting. And that's what made it truly interesting.
Historic, actually.
Yes, it was, because I was the first Black woman to conduct the Houston Symphony. And that was the summer of 1989. Very exciting. I was very nervous, but I was very excited performing William Dawson's Negro Folk Symphony. One of the things that I loved about doing it was my African-American players who were playing next to the professional orchestra. And we know that professional orchestras, they spend 24/7 practicing and working on their music and things like that. Many of my players, they did music, but they also had a job. They taught school or they worked in business. So the music was part of their lives. When my Black players were sitting next to the Houston Symphony members, a couple of them said they were surprised that the Houston Symphony had their pencil out and they were making marks on the page and putting counting and the kinds of things that musicians do when they're dealing with new music, because this was a new piece for them. They'd never played Dawson's Negro Folk Symphony. So the kind of markings that musicians do when they're dealing with new music, it wasn't a Beethoven or a Brahms piece that they played many, many times. And my players would come to me and say, wow, they're just like us. You have to make notes and put eyeglasses on, put things marking off beats or marking up bowings and fingerings for the violin parts. So that was one of those things I really felt good about, because sometimes we listen to a professional orchestra, the Houston Symphony, the New York Philharmonic, LA Philharmonic, and we think they're like gods or something from a musical standpoint. They're just trained musicians. I mean, highly trained. They spent their entire lives doing music. That's true, but they're musicians. So the kind of work that we do, the kind of practice that, you know, when I'm talking to my students, that you got to go home and practice that section in the middle is not good. You gotta work on that. They would be marking off parts to at least look over that part later to make sure that they could, you know, execute those tricky spots.
Okay, so here it is. You made this great historic moment honoring this great composer, being the first African-American to conduct the Houston Symphony Orchestra. How long after that did you decide to go and get your doctoral degree in music education? And again, what was your thesis on?
That would take a little bit longer. In the meantime, I fell in love, got married, started a family. It would be several years before I would go back and work on my doctorate. At that point, Texas Southern University, our HBCU campus here in Houston, they didn't have an orchestra. They hadn't had an orchestra since like the 60s. And so I came to them again. I'm constantly coming up to people say, hey, let's do orchestra. So I came to TSU. It's like, hey, can we do a student orchestra? And again, they were like, well, yeah, if you can do it and get it going. So I spent my entire life just starting.
So were there students there that played instruments in their department?
A few, yes. At the beginning, it was very tiny. I think I had like 4 students at first. And then I would literally walk around on campus, again, way before cell phones, computers, and all that other stuff. I just put up posters. Did you used to play the violin? Did you used to play the cello? You know, did you like to play the trumpet in an orchestra? And so over time, it just kind of grew. It was still relatively, it wasn't as big as the band, the Ocean of Soul, the Great Ocean of Soul, or even the Wonderful Choir. But it was still an HBCU that had an orchestra program. And that was unique. That really was. There were only a few. So that's what I started working on in terms of my doctorate. I wanted to, the orchestra, we hit more than a speed bump. And we hit a time period where the budget got cut, Texas Southern University, the budget got cut. So as I said, the orchestra was one of the smaller groups. The orchestra and a couple of little small ensembles. They're not going to cut the band. They're not going to cut the choir. But some of the small ensembles just got eliminated. So I didn't have a job, frankly. You know, I was teaching intro to music classes and those kinds of things. But that my heart wasn't there. You have to do what you have to do to pay bills. I started thinking about, okay, what are the other HBCU orchestras like? And what are their trials and tribulations? What are their triumphs? What are their successes? What's going on with them? That's when I started going to Howard University and going to Prairie View. They had an orchestra and some of the other HBCUs that did have orchestras, and interviewing their conductors and just asking them, what's it like? How did this come to be? What are your passions? What are the challenges? There was pretty much funds was usually one of the main things, because relatively speaking, they had these tiny budgets. You know, and if you're trying to do a program with a tiny budget, you don't have much money for scholarships for the students, that's when your program can be in jeopardy. I did discover that those HBCU orchestra conductors were fiercely committed to their orchestras. They would do anything practically. Now, I know that's the way I felt when I was at DSU doing the orchestra there. I would do practically anything. If that mean I had to go pick up some kids because they didn't have a ride, hey, I'd go pick them up. If so-and-so needed a string and they didn't have it, hey, I got some spare string. You fight like crazy because the orchestras are always, as I said, so much smaller than the bands and the choirs. If you really love it and you really care about it.
What did you end up doing your thesis on? I'm curious.
I interviewed 5 orchestra conductors at HBCUs. We gave them different pseudonames. There was me and my advisor. We came up with a variety of questions to ask them about what their experiences were like, what are their challenges, what are their successes, you know, what advice would you give to other people that would want to do an orchestra at an HBCU? And that's what it was about. I mean, there was other information that I included in there, again, about Black composers, the Black orchestra experience, because my paper contains basically kind of a historical overview of the Black orchestra experience here in this country. So ranging from back in New Orleans, not a lot of people know, but even back in New Orleans during the time of enslavement, there was an orchestra of Black folk made up of both enslaved, some enslaved people and some free people. As we knew in New Orleans had a mixture, but they had an orchestra there, okay? During the time of enslavement. There were early orchestras, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century of various kinds. Some lasted a short period of time. Some lasted a longer period of time. Even in Houston, there was an orchestra made up of Black women in 1915 called the Ladies Orchestra. The Ladies Orchestra.
That's fascinating.
I know. And the great thing about it is that when I found the picture, and I have this picture, I published this article years ago. I was able to interview the little girl who was in the picture at that point. And she was when I saw her, she was quite elderly. Ernestine Jesse Covington Dent. Very much the Covington family in Houston. The Dr. Covington was very much one of the early doctors, medical doctors here in Houston. And they had the Covington House. It got destroyed a few years ago. I was just really heartbroken. But the Covington House was a place where when Booker T. Washington was touring, he'd stay at the Covington House because they didn't have any hotels. Or if Marian Anderson was touring, she'd stay at the Covington House because, again, there were no hotels. I mean, it was that kind of a place. But this girl, Jessie Covington Dent, who would be a professional musician herself, she told me about the orchestra, the Ladies Orchestra, and what they did. And that, again, that combination, forgive me, I can just go on and on about this, but this
please continue.
It's a strong connection between Houston and New Orleans. I mean, we're practically neighbors, you know what I mean? I know it's 6 or 5 hours apart, whatever, you know, but I mean, in terms of the kinds of things that we shared, one of the things that we shared, because there was a small group of ladies in New Orleans in the early 1900s, 1901, 02, 03, somewhere in there. And that was part of what they were doing. And there was the man who was over that would do he worked the railroad, okay? And we know about Pullman porters and the Black people that worked the railroads. And he would come into town and he would do some coaching with the ladies group here in Houston. That would form a little later than the one they had in New Orleans. But again, I cannot overstress. There are scholars. I know people want to go online and just, if you can't, you know, touch it in 30 seconds, you're not interested in it anymore. But I don't know how to say it. You got to go back and read some books, you know, read a whole book, which I thought with my younger play, is like a whole book. And I'm like, yeah, the whole book, you know, because there's so much that we're not getting I'll just say the meat of it, of our Black music experience. We're only getting this surface one or two names, which, you know, I don't know, that's okay for some people. But to me, there's so many things that Black folk have done, and we need to know more about our contribution. We have done so many wonderful things. We just need to know about it.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio. I'm Fahima Sek. The show is What's at Stake. And my guest today is Dr. Ann Lundy, who is the executive director of the Houston Music Center. And she was the first African-American woman to conduct the Houston Symphony Orchestra. Now, was that at the Miller Theater as well back in 89 when you had that opportunity?
Yes, it was. Yeah, both in 89 and then in 90 when I was when I approached them about celebrating Scott Joplin's 125th anniversary. So on that one, we did some of his music from the opera Treemonitia, his opera Treemonitia, and some of his other pieces that he had composed, that Scott Joplin had composed. So yeah, 1989 and then 1990, that's when we did our two shows out at Miller Outdoor Theater.
And then you were recently, we're currently on the heels of you being at the Miller Theater for the Philly Soul Volume 5. And it was a tribute to the late Frankie Beverly. So talk about how you bridge the gap between classical music and contemporary music. Talk about that fusion.
Okay, well, that is great. Like I said, I grew up as a kid loving, you know, the Motown songs, the Philly soul sounds, the Atlantic records, you know, all these great songs and even blues. My dad was fond of the Ink Spots. I mean, you know, so I didn't grow up exclusively with classical music. I mean, I like classical music, but I also loved you know, the wonderful sounds, the doo-wop on up through the shake it, you know, kind of music that we were dancing to back then. And I've always wanted to continue to let people know that the orchestra is not something that you can only play one kind of music. We can play all kinds of music. So over the years, we've done, as I said, Motown music. We've done Philly, that great Philly sound. We did a big tribute, you know, just recently. I mean, when Aretha Franklin passed a few years ago, we did a playing some of her great sounds. Roberta Flack. Oh, I loved her. I mean, so we were playing some of her music too. So when Frankie Beverly, you know, passed a few months ago, I just thought that it was a great opportunity to play some of his music. So, you know, That's the Golden Time of Day, or Southern Girls. As you see, I'm no vocalist, but that doesn't mean, you know, you can still have fun even if you're not a great singer. That kind of great music that we just love to listen to. So yeah, Frankie Beverly, and some of his great tunes. And we also did other Philly music, because we did the great tune For the Love of Money. Boom, 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 dun, 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 money, 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 money. Great, not great voice, but I can still shake the music and make everybody, they always get up and dance. When we do Money, when we do a ballad like Sadie, oh, lovely sweet Sadie, or the Philly, the sound to the Soul Train. You know, those were great Philly sounds too. So we did Philly music, and then we did a special spotlight on Frankie Beverly.
Yeah, I understand it was very well attended.
It was
very well attended.
We had a great crowd, and the audience got into it. I mean, it was a great crowd. They were singing and clapping and dancing.
Now, I know a few years ago, I think it was, I don't remember what Super Bowl it was, but you had the opportunity to accompany Beyonce. Talk a little bit about that, how that came about, and her involvement with the Music Center.
Okay. Well, if I go way back, we used to lease a spot, a space on Alameda, and that's where we had our Community Music Center of Houston, Community Music Center of Houston. That's where we were teaching music lessons. We had groups that would come in there and practice. And one of these little groups that were coming in there with these little bitty girls called Girls Time, and they were just doing their little thing, and the daddy was working with them and so forth. So it goes all the way back in terms of when she was a little girl and these were little bitty types, you know, just working on those early sounds. But in terms of the Super Bowl thing, the band was doing the halftime show. And then the Beyonce people said, you know, I'd like for Beyonce to do the national anthem accompanied by an orchestra. We'd like it to be, you know, more Black folk, because she was talking about the great Whitney Houston and the work that she had done with the other orchestra. But they specifically wanted, you know, more Black folk. And I was like, okay, we got Black folk, you know, because this has always been my passion. It wasn't, you know, all Black, but a lot of Black orchestra players. So they asked us and we said yes. So we accompanied her on the that Super Bowl. They have the numbers for it. I forget which number it is, but just look up. You can look it on YouTube. That first one where she was wearing this beautiful white, this very classy white outfit or whatever. And she sang and we were playing along with her.
Now, I think shortly after that, weren't you inducted into some honorary Hall of Fame?
I've been blessed to receive a number of awards. State of Texas, Austin, and have given me those nice awards. I'm trying to think of Hall of Fame. That's not ringing a bell. Sorry about that.
As I was doing my research, I did come across that.
Okay, then forgive me. One of the things about me, right or wrong, is that I'm probably just thinking about the next show. And sometimes when people will honor me and my work and so forth, I'm very grateful and I say thank you, but I'm probably thinking about the next concert, because that's what I got to concentrate on. So that's just the way my brain works.
Understood. How did you become the executive director of the Music Center. Talk about how you came to the Music Center, a little history on the Music Center and how it was founded and how you actually came to the position that you're in.
Ron Scales was one of our founders. I ran into him in 1980, probably 80 or 81. And he asked if I would join the Community Music Center of Houston. And at that time, I was like, wow, that sounds exciting. Sure. You know, you want to be our executive director? And I was like, wow, I've never been executive director before. Ooh, this is a, I just thought it was a big deal. Of course, at that point, it was more like an idea in Ron Scales' head. You know, I said, okay, sure. So I brought my string quartet over. And from there, the orchestra grew. And then my title changed from executive director to music director, because that gave me a chance, frankly, to just concentrate on just the music, because I found that I'm much better, frankly, at music than I am with paperwork. I'm a little better with the music and the scores and the rehearsals. So now my title is music director, which I love for all kinds of reasons, because that gives me a chance to really work on my music, work with the kids, help them grow musically, and getting the other concerts together. So that's where we are.
I understand, if I'm not mistaken, the Music Center is going to have a new home. Could you talk a little bit about that?
It's in Houston's Third Ward. It's 3020 Holman Street. For some people that are old enough to remember, it's right across the street from the old Riverside Hospital. Now, Riverside Hospital was the Black hospital for a number of years. I think it may have been Texas's first Black hospital. Now, don't quote me, but I know it was certainly one of the earliest Black hospitals in the state, certainly in Houston. They're doing some renovations, and catty corner to that is our building, 3020 Holman. And one of the doctors that worked at the hospital had his clinic there, and he would treat the patients and so forth. So a few years ago, thanks to our board and Liz Watkins, they purchased the building, and we've been holding on to it since then, because we initially thought it would be a good place to have our community music center, where we could teach our music lessons and have rehearsals and shows and things like that. But then we found out that John Chase, the first Black architect in the state of Texas, John Chase, oh, I got so excited, that he had designed that building. Now, Chase has designed a number of churches and other buildings throughout the country, certainly in Houston and Austin. But when we found that that was one of those buildings that Chase had designed, then we were like, oh, we have to preserve this building. We just have to. Right now, Houston is going through gentrification, and that's a fact of life. Some of us are working really, really hard to preserve portions of our Black heritage and just not see it torn down. We receive a number of developers that want to purchase the land and just destroy the building. Of course, the building has no meaning to them, but it means a lot to us. We're holding on to it, and we are going to make it happen. You would ask me exactly how it's going to happen in terms of the funding that we need. I don't have the specifics, but I have faith. I have faith, and I know somehow we're going to get the necessary funds to renovate the building.
Well, we're under the tyranny of the clock, and as such, I'd like you to tell those in our listening audience what's on the horizon for the Houston Music Center and how they could be of help and how they can support.
Okay, well, great. If you're going through looking for Community Music Center of Houston, the first word is community. So Community Music Center of Houston, if you go online and go cmchouston.org, I'm going to repeat just the letter C-M-C and then to spell out Houston, H-O-U-S-T-O-N.org. For organization, for a nonprofit organization, which we are tax exempt and all that routine, then you can learn more about what we are doing, what our plans are. There are various designs that architects have been proposing in terms of how to preserve the basic architecture of the building and yet still expand it and get a little more space for a little more lessons or bigger rehearsal space or more concert space and things like that. So check us out at cmchouston.org. Give us a call. Can I give old-fashioned phone numbers?
Please do.
Okay. I know not everybody uses it, but it's 713-523-9710. Repeating 713-523-9710. So just check out Community Music Center of Houston. Give us a call. You can come by if you want to just drive by and see the building. You know, we'll do whatever we can whatever will help us to get in the building. Because right now, I'm teaching at my house. I'm teaching my kiddies at my house. Another was teaching at a church, and somebody else was teaching at a community center. And we're just all over the place. We need to get in our home.
Well, whatever it takes. And I thank you, Dr. Ann Lundy, the musical director of the Community Music Center of Houston, first African-American woman to conduct a symphony orchestra in Houston, Texas, the founder of the William Grant Steele String Quartet, and the Scott Joplin Orchestra. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on What's at Stake. And I want to say shout out to our executive director, Verna Avery Brown. I'm Fahima Sek. Please stay tuned for Wake Up and Stay Woke. Dr. Lundy, thank you so much.
You had great questions. I appreciate your interest.
Thank you again.
All right. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Will, what that is? Do you not get the concept?
We're going to go out with a little fusion. Finesse featuring Concept P of On No Sleep with Michael Prince on the violin.
Not get the concept?
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
WPFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, will feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Full schedule found on WPFWFM.org.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, Washington.
In commemoration of International Jazz Day, Friends of the Congo, Africa World Now Project, WPFW, and the Institute of Musical Traditions presents an evening examining jazz, espionage, and colonialism in Africa with a free screening of Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat on Wednesday, April 30, 6:30 p.m. at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street Northwest, steps away from the Tacoma Park Metro. The evening concludes with a panel discussion. Seating is limited, so registration is required. Details at Eventbrite and then searching Friends of the Congo. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.